Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Welcome live to Close Up Radio Live, a service of the Teleworking Close Up Television and Radio Live. Great to have you with us today. Also great to have Dr. William Lester with us, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, of course, in chemistry. He came from the south side of Chicago, he says, and was given a typing test at the University of Chicago, where he did well. Subsequently, he was offered one of two jobs, cleaning monkey cages in the medical school for 88 cents an hour, or typing for a professor of molecular physics at the University of Chicago for $1.09 an hour. Head over to the physics area as a high school senior, and he was awarded the, Victor A. Adams Scholarship, which led him to going to the University of Chicago. He also received his master's degree at the University of Chicago. He attended Washington University in St. Louis for doctoral studies for a year, then went to the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., with research at the National Bureau of Standards. His first job after receiving his doctorate and followed by a postdoctoral appointment at the Theoretical Chemistry Institute, Department of Chemistry, University of Wisconsin-Madison, that was a non-tenured lecturer in the UW Department of Chemistry, and he was selected in 1978 as director of the newly created National Resource for Computation and Chemistry, cited at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and appointed at LBNL Associate Director. With the close of the NRCC in 1981, he was appointed professor in the Department of Chemistry, University of California, Berkeley, and faculty senior scientist at LBNL. He became the first black professor in the Department of Chemistry. And his father once told him that you can do anything in life that you can put your mind to, which is incredible and very insightful information. And to hear it from a dad, it's the best. And we are very honored to have him here on the show. He comes with great credential, great experience, but great wisdom and insight as well. Join me in welcoming live and direct from California, Dr. William Lester, to Close Up Radio Live. Dr. Lester, thank you very much for joining us here on the program today. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be involved in this way.
We're excited to have you here as well. I mentioned a little bit of the scenario early on that pointed you in the direction of kind of having a real thirst for the sciences and enjoying what you do. But let's go back in time. Tell us about those early sort of journey moments in your life that pointed you in this direction of wanting to do this kind of work.
Well, the first inclinations toward chemistry arose as a very young fellow listening to radio. And commercials, the DuPont commercials, Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry, which fascinated me. So chemistry held the fascination. Knew nothing about what it was all about, but still the notion, the idea of chemistry, which I had heard in these commercials, was intriguing. So in point of fact that, When I went to high school, Calumet High School on the south side of Chicago, and took chemistry, I worked very hard and actually achieved some success. There used to be competitions in the classroom. The instructor would line us up on either side, and like a spelling bee contest, would ask us questions, and we'd have to sit down if we missed the questions. And I would win a number of these. Now, the somewhat novel aspect of all of this is something I'll have to back up and give you some insight on, and that is my upbringing on the South Side in the following sense, that as a young fellow, the family, I had at the time two sisters, and with my parents, we lived in a two-bedroom apartment in an apartment building south west of the University of Chicago. This is a neighborhood called Woodlawn. And it became the situation that our mother was in the hospital to deliver another girl. And so the decision was made, we had to get this boy out of the bedroom. And so we moved up to a project. And most people, when I say that, say, what? Yes, oh, yes. We moved up because we needed this additional bedroom. And we found one in a project called Princeton Park, which was located on the far south side of Chicago, 90th and 95th, Wentworth to Harvard. And it led to my going to the local elementary school, Gillespie Elementary School, in the third grade. I was in third grade when this transition occurred. And it was the case that the previous elementary school integrated teachers, all black school, to an elementary school with all black teachers who were superb. But I should back up for a moment and talk about what life on the South Side was like in that general time frame. Oh, by the way, there's a wonderful book called The Autobiography of Black Chicago for those who are interested. Should take a look at it. It's written by a fellow by the name of Dempsey Travis, who was a realtor in Chicago in that general time frame and talked about the nature of residential segregation in Chicago at that time, the aspect of blockbusting, of restrictive covenants, and how they so dominated everything. And I saw that progression during the course of my life, which really enlightened me in terms of the way things occurred in the city. Go on and talk about Calumet and the nature of our populace from Princeton Park going to the area high school. And I was in about the fourth or fifth cadre of black students to go to the school. To give you some sense of that, when I graduated from Calumet, I was one of eight black students in a class of 360. And it was the case that there was this scholarship endowed by a previous librarian at the high school to the University of Chicago. Now, although I graduated 15th in this class, and I applied to the various four-year institutions in the Chicago area, I received no financial support to attend any of them, and so I was prepared to go to one of the community colleges in the area. But I was fortunately selected as one of three students to attend the University of Chicago on the Victoria Adams Scholarship. Now, this scholarship had been dormant for a number of years, had not been used. And so I received it, and the white girl and the white guy. And after a year, the white girl said there was no social life to speak of at the University of Chicago, and she went to the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And the guy came to California because he was interested in things out here. I don't know what they were, but that was the nature of it all. And so that's how I got to the University of Chicago. And it was the case that my father, who had been successful in passing the civil service exam in the mid-30s and became a mail carrier, could not afford to send me to such places, even the other places in the city of Chicago that I mentioned, the other four-year institutions. And so this was a very fortunate twist in terms of this kind of exposure. So that gives you, I think, a sense of how I got to the University of Chicago. But excuse me, furthermore, what you mentioned earlier in terms of the employment at the University of Chicago, which occurred as a consequence of folks telling me that they were hiring over at the University of Chicago, and I went to the University of Chicago Employment Office, and the remainder you have mentioned already. And so it was to the laboratory of molecular structure and spectra, a part of the Department of Physics at the University of Chicago, under the direction of Robert Mulliken, who subsequently won a Nobel Prize some 15 or so years later, that I was exposed to computers at a time when they were hardly being used. Well, they were really still under development at that point. And maybe I should stop at this point and see what crosses your mind in terms of things that we should focus on.
Anybody ever tell you you have a terrific speaking voice?
Well, thank you
very
much.
You sound like an announcer. It's terrific. Mm-hmm. Just listening to the textural quality and the inflection and the articulation. And, you know, being a professor, you have to have that as well. But it's a wonderful voice that you've got.
Well, thanks again.
Yeah. Genetics.
So should
and,
talk about computing and what I was exposed to and the evolution that I saw? Maybe
that
that's something that may be worthwhile yakking about for a few moments.
Yeah, bringing that into the equation. I think our listeners would love hearing that.
Okay, well, let me just take one step back from that and say that the job typing at the Laboratory of Molecular Structure and Spectra involved typing on one of the earliest electric typewriters. It was an IBM typewriter before Selectric, which had interchangeable keys for math symbols and the Greek alphabet. The job really was typing reports for the Office of Naval Research, an agency funding research at the Laboratory of Molecular Structure and Spectra. And so this was a fascinating process. After my first year of undergrad and keeping this job during the course of school year as part-time employment, that summer, Professor Clemens Rotan, who was the second in command of the laboratory, said, you know, I should sit in on this course he was going to be teaching on computing. Now, it turned out to be something we call machine language programming. And not to spend a lot of time on this, this is the very beginning. This is the instructions that that computer gets to do things internally. And so after a summer of instruction on this, I felt I didn't want to do anything with this business. I did not care for it at all. It was tedious at a level that really bothered me. But then later, very shortly thereafter, there came symbolic programming languages. And these, I'm sure, almost everyone is familiar with. And this was the early stages of, for example, Fortran and so on. In any event, the graduate students and postdoctoral associates involved with the laboratory would write code. But the fact of the matter was, at the time, now we're talking mid-50s, there were no computers on campus. As a matter of fact, you couldn't find computers hardly anywhere. And what the graduate students and postdoctoral associates had to do was catch a train to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in order to carry out calculations. And I even remember the manufacturer of the machines they used, or Remington Rand, 1103, 1103A, these kinds of things. And so it was a very early stage when you consider that at this time, the nature of what computation can do is just amazing. So in any event, undergraduate as a chemistry major at the University of Chicago, I completed the program and applied for doctoral studies at a number of institutions. I wasn't as successful as I had been in high school. I finished with B-minus average, but I was known on campus, by the way. I should add that I had received the Alumni Dean's Award as a sophomore, the Amos Alonzo Stagg Medal when I finished, and these were outgrowths of the fact that I made the basketball team. Now, you must appreciate that athletics at the University of Chicago, when I went there, were hardly looked at. To give you a sense of the basketball situation, I encountered a situation where, well, I encountered, rather, the coach we had, who was one of the 212 lettermen in the history of the University of Chicago, who had earned his letters under the direction of Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was one of the very early coaches of football. Recalling now that the University of Chicago was only established in 1896, that the coach was an All-American in 1908 or 9 or so, and later in his career, early 20s, was coaching basketball at the University of Utah and was the first coach to bring both guards down the floor. What does that mean? That in those days earlier, one guard would stay back and guard the basket. if you can believe. And so it was the case that when I got to the University of Chicago, the basketball team had a record of one win and 47 losses over the previous 3 years. But to comment further with regards to athletics at the University of Chicago, I always want to bring up the fact that who was the first Heisman Trophy winner? His name was Jay Berwanger. What school? University of Chicago. But what happened in 1939? The University of Chicago dropped football. They were a doormat in the Big Ten Conference. And then in 1945, the University of Chicago dropped out of the Big Ten Conference. And it was said by the then iconic chancellor of the University of Chicago, Robert Maynard Hutchins, he would say that when I think about exercising, I lay down and roll over and let the feeling pass. So this gives you some sense of the climate at that time. But one final aspect in the terms of athletics is the fact that I was inducted into the Athletics Hall of Fame of the University of Chicago in 2004. And I will stop at this point on this trend.
So, really amazing. Yeah. Your lecturer experience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, that is something very special as well. Tell us about those experiences.
Well, I don't know if it was very special because actually I had applied for a regular faculty position. And I had applied after having been a postdoctoral associate in the group of one Professor Richard Bernstein, highly recognized for his work in molecular beam scattering, who had moved from the University of Michigan to the University of Wisconsin. And I should back up and say that with regards to my research done at the National Bureau of Standards, this was really a very important dimension. But even before that, let me say this, that let me go back and give a little background in terms of my master's work and then on to University of Washington University of St. Louis, because it was the case that the chair of chemistry at the University of Chicago at that time said, after I had been denied pursuit of higher education at other institutions, because typically it was you leave the institution you got your bachelor's degree at and move on to someplace else for your PhD, and having been denied, he said, well, to me, I could come back and to the university and do a master's degree there. And this I did under the direction of a then new professor, Professor Stuart Rice, who had come from Harvard, Society of Fellows and all of that. And he actually had interactions with a professor from Washington University who would come, Professor Alfred Holzer. And I applied to Washington University. But also a postdoctoral associate in Mulliken's group at Chicago in the Laboratory of Molecular Structure and Spectra had indicated to me that, hey, you see those guys, the graduate students and postdocs? He said, they're all physics majors. And if you want to be in there, you have to change your major. I said, no way I'm changing my major. Not after work, all the work I had done. And he said, but I am a chemistry graduate. Oh, really? I got my degree from the Catholic University of America. And that is how the consideration of Catholic University came up. And so when I applied to Washington University, I also applied to Catholic U. Now, my letter from Catholic University, one which indicated I had been admitted, went to, believe it or not, Dr. William Lester, head of student health at the University of Chicago. No relationship. Went to a sanitarium in Elmhurst, Illinois, and arrived to me after the April 15th deadline by which you had to respond to the invitation. And so that's why I went off to Washington University. Now, there's another very personal dimension here which comes into play, and that is that I got married at just after Christmas in 1959 in Chicago, after having spent my first semester at Wash U. And long story short, that fall semester, I'd gotten a C in the physics department electricity and magnetism course, but I felt that would not be a complication. You know, I had to maintain a B average because I would get an A, I felt, in quantum chemistry, something I'd taken as an undergrad at Chicago and as a master's student as well. And when I took the course and got the grade at WashU after taking the course, I got a B+. And they said, Lester, you're out of here. You have a master's already. The reason I go on to mention getting an opportunity to work that summer at Washington University with one of the professors was because with marriage, and I should add, with pregnancy of my new wife, I needed a job. And so I went to companies that presumably would hire a chemistry major in St. Louis, Mallinckrodt Chemical, Monsanto Chemical, and Tri-City Oil. And though I had a master's degree and a year of study beyond it, no one would hire me. And that's why I look back on it with such warm feelings regarding the professor who hired me for that summer to do these experiments. But the experiments themselves were really something else in the sense that they were difficult. They were to seed crystals of germanium hexafluoride with manganese as a dopant. You get something called an electron spin resonance signal. And you precipitated these crystals out of hydrogen fluoride, the most corrosive acid you can find. And I did this in a hood. And I spent a summer of making these beautiful crystals, but never getting the signal I sought. Well, I had in the meantime written to Catholic University regarding continuing my graduate studies there. And they said, yes, come. But it was the case that they were only paying $1,000 for the academic year. Now, mind you, I'd gone to Washington University with the magnificent sum of $1,600 for the academic year. but it was the case that my girlfriend, subsequent wife, had said, well, what about me? And I said, well, I don't have the money to support a wife. And she said, well, I'll work. She had graduated from Howard University and had been working as a social worker in Chicago. And I said, on that basis, after looking at the numbers, we decided to get married, as I mentioned. Well, long story short, in terms of the end of the summer in St. Louis, we motored from St. Louis to D.C. so I could continue education at Catholic. But I also, while working that academic year, this is the academic year of, let's see, it would have been 60-61, working in D.C., living in an apartment. I'll call it an apartment, but it was the back part of a single-family dwelling in southeast Washington that it became clear I needed to get some money. So I contacted the postdoctoral associate at Chicago regarding how to get some money. And he said, well, hey, get in touch with this fellow at the National Bureau of Standards. His name was Morris Krauss, which I did. And they have summer internships, and that's where I went after this first academic year at Catholic. And I came back to school, and my pockets were jingling. And the second academic year at Catholic was okay, but then that spring, Krauss got in touch with me and said, would I want to come back to the Bureau the next summer? And I said, well, I would like to, but I know I need to finish up my education as soon as possible because a second child was on the way. The previous year, let's see, when would have been? that spring. It was February of 61 that William A. Lester the third was born. In any event, in light of the situation of possibly needing, you know, some more money, notwithstanding the need to get out of school, I talked to my research advisor, Dr. Professor Virginia Griffin, one of the few women internationally in theoretical chemistry who had been the advisor to the postdoctoral associate at the University of Chicago, Dr. Bernard Ransel. She said to me, Lester, what do you want? to make money or to get an education. And basically, I said, well, I needed to do both. She unfortunately passed that spring of an aneurysm. And so on this basis, I went to the Bureau of Standards that summer. But Krauss had also mentioned that it often is the case that students do research for their doctorates at the Bureau while after interning and so forth. And this was a possibility. And so the last 2 years of my PhD research were done as an employee of the Bureau of Standards. As a matter of fact, as a, I'd call a GS-7, yeah, the GS-7 level of employment, which dramatically changed my financial situation. And so it was the case, knowing that one did a postdoctoral year or two of study after the PhD, I applied to do that, and that's what led to my going to the University of Wisconsin's Theoretical Chemistry Institute with Bernstein. And so I took an educational leave of absence to do that. And so after getting there, that is to TCI, Bernstein said, we would like you to be the or to take the job of assistant director of the Theoretical Chemistry Institute. I said, but you know I'm on education leave from the Bureau of Standards. That's okay. Take the job. Take the job. Well, after much urging, I said, okay, you know that I'll leave at the end of the year. I'll do that. And so I did, and I went to the office I was to occupy as assistant director and read correspondence from the program manager who interacted with the director of the institute. And in this was a NASA-funded institute, and the program manager had in the second paragraph of a letter to the director that the institute needed to diversify. And I was the only game in town. This was, to some extent, before affirmative action really became something you heard a great deal about. And I said, gee, this is an affirmative action job. Now, another byproduct of that, fascinating enough, was being able to read my file. And a fascinating aspect of that was that I read the letters of recommendation. Oh, Lester, he's okay. You know, he can do the work. but in terms of other black applicants, some of these letters were just terrible. Has a chip on his shoulder, this, that, and the other, and so forth. And so it was just an amazing revelation as to the problems as a black student that you encountered at this level of education. And so it was truly, truly something else. But in any event, getting back to what I was doing, I had become involved with scattering at TCI. My graduate studies were in what we call electronic structure. And I won't go into that in any detail, but let me just get away from the science to some extent and indicate that after giving my talk to become a regular faculty member, assistant professor in the chemistry department at Wisconsin, Bernstein indicated that everyone was supportive except the director of the institute, Joseph Hirschfelder, who was an icon in the field. And so on that basis, because I was not strongly interested in returning to the Bureau of Standards, I had actually resigned and stayed on for a second year of postdoctoral experience. And it was after that second year that I gave the talk to become a faculty member and then became a lecturer in the chemistry department. And while being a lecturer, my salary was paid by a Theoretical Chemistry Institute. And in 1967, they said the funds are getting tight and they had to let me go, and so I need to look for a job. And so it was the case that I had applied to give talks in 1968 at an American Physical Society meeting at the University of California, Berkeley, followed 2 weeks later by the American Chemical Society meeting in San Francisco, at which I had an abstract accepted to give a talk. But there was a week or two in between that was available, and my second sister, Judith Wiley, became her name, lived in Hayward, California, and it provided, staying with her, the opportunity to take my now two children to Disneyland.
Amazing.
And so with borrowing my brother-in-law's car to drive there. But it also afforded the opportunity Hello?
We may have to have you come back. The half hour is done. That was a very fast 30 minutes. The show is coming to a real fast end here, Dr. Lester. We'll have to have you back for part two so we can talk about your time at IBM and so much more. But thanks for sharing all of this with us. It's an extraordinary and illustrious story, career, family, and so much more, and so inspiring. And hopefully we'll welcome you back real soon to pick up where we left off, expand, maybe hear some more success stories. That would truly be a pleasure, Doctor.
Thank you. I didn't realize it was only a half an hour. I thought it was an hour.
Yeah. They're 30-minute shows. Yeah, 30-minute.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you
but
very much.
But it was phenomenal. It's really, really engaging. So I hope you enjoyed the time with me as much as I absolutely have with you, and hopefully we'll welcome you back soon, and we can expand further to part two of your extraordinary story, Doctor. Thanks for all the work that you've done for the good of all of us, and hope to chat again soon on the program.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You be well. Our very special guest, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry, Dr. William Lester. What an extraordinary story, right? He just was sharing so much. Hopefully we'll have him back so we can expand more because he's got such an extraordinary story. Jim Masters thanking him and thanking you for your time this time. Till next time on Close Up Radio. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.